It is really nice to be here this morning. I've been looking forward to it all week. And one of the reasons I look forward to it is that Church of England only does 10-minute sermons. So I haven't brought my watch, I brought my diary. I didn't put it on my phone because the battery will die before we're ready. No, I kid you. I'm only kidding. It is good to be on a journey together. And I want to read some verses from Mark's Gospel, from the end of chapter 8 and the first part of chapter 9. And as I read these verses, I want you to try and figure out what you think the link is between the two incidents that I'm going to read about. Oh, well done. Someone's put it up. Thank you for doing that. So starting at verse 31 of Mark chapter 8. Then he began to teach them that the Son of Man must undergo great suffering and be rejected by the elders, the chief priests, and the scribes, and be killed, and after 3 days rise again. He said all this quite openly, and Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him. But turning and looking at his disciples, he rebuked Peter and said, "Get behind me, Satan, for you are setting your mind not on divine things, but on human things." He called the crowd with his disciples and said to them, "If any want to become my followers, let them deny themselves and take up their cross and follow me. For those who want to save their life will lose it, and those who lose their life for my sake and for the sake of the gospel will save it. For what will it profit them to gain the whole world and forfeit their life? Indeed, what can they give in return for their life?" And then from the beginning of chapter 9. 6 days later, Jesus took with him Peter and James and John and led them up a high mountain by themselves. And he was transfigured before them, and his clothes became dazzling white, such as no one on earth could bleach them. And there appeared to them Elijah and Moses, who were talking with Jesus. When Peter said to Jesus, "Rabbi, it is good for us to be here. Let us make 3 dwellings, one for you, one for Moses, and one for Elijah," he didn't know what to say, for they were terrified. Then a cloud overshadowed them, and from the cloud there came a voice, "This is my Son, the Beloved. Listen to him." Suddenly, when they looked around, they saw no one with them anymore, but only Jesus. So, 2 very different episodes, but there is a link. Anybody want to hazard a guess? It's more rhetorical. I'm not really expecting you to, but the link is that Jesus gives 2 different invitations. He invites his followers every day, deny yourself, pick up your cross, and follow me. That's an invitation. That is an invitation extended to every one of us. The second is an invitation to go up the mountain and to have a glimpse of glory. And that's also an invitation to each of us. And I want to kind of put what I'm going to say in the context overall, that being a follower of Christ, being a disciple of Christ, is a journey of participating. We are called, we are invited to participate in the mission and vision of God in this place. We are called daily to deny ourselves, to do the hard stuff, to experience the hard stuff. And we all know what that feels like. But there's a promise, because we're invited also every now and again to go up the mountain and have a glimpse of God's glory. And what I want to talk about this morning is, from a very personal perspective, my experience that in the heart of the hard stuff, we get glimpses of transformation. We get glimpses of glory. We get glimpses in the most unexpected places. We find renewal. We find refreshment in the places you never would expect. They seem insignificant, but they're not. And I want to just, and as I say, this is a very personal reflection, really, on my own kind of life as a Christian, I suppose. And I want to talk about three journeys, thinking about participation in terms of being three different sorts of journeys. There's been, for me, and there may well have been for you, a journey of letting go. A journey of letting go. It's a journey. A journey of letting go is a journey into vulnerability, into the unknown. I started my career in science. I was a research scientist. I worked in scientific laboratories in London, first of all. And it was in the heady days, the early days of what was called then genetic engineering, fiddling around with DNA and all that stuff. And it was really interesting. And I was doing this in the context of vaccine development, developing vaccines for polio, which is almost eradicated from the globe as we speak. This was in the early 80s, which dates me. And it was a really exciting journey. It was amazing. I don't know how I got there. I was a classic underachiever at school. And the thought that I would end up, well, first of all, going to university was quite a surprise. But then 6 years later, walking out with a PhD, well, I wrote to the headmaster, who had written all those horrible reports that were frighteningly true at the time. And I said, do you know what? But I had this abiding knowledge, this abiding sense, this isn't what I'm going to end up doing for the whole of my life. This is crazy. Someone's going to find out that I know nothing. Someone's going to find out that I'm no good at this stuff. And I just knew that this was not going to be the career I would be in for the whole of my life. But I was in it long enough to learn some amazing things about creation. They say there aren't many scientists who are Christians. Well, I would contradict that. There are lots. Just think about. Come here. This fine body of a man is made up of about somewhere between 13 and 15 trillion cells, little building blocks that make Richard. That number is big. Huh? Could be a few less. Well, go to the gym. Go to the gym. Each of those cells, pretty much each of those cells, except your, I won't embarrass you any further, Richard, thank you. Each of those cells, except for your red blood cells, your red corpuscles, each of those cells has a nucleus in it, a little compartment floating around in the middle of these trillions and trillions of cells. And in that nucleus lies the DNA, the chromosomes, the code that makes you, you. And every one of those cells has exactly the same copy of DNA. Now, here's the amazing thing. 13 to 15, you're saying there might be 16. 12, you think 12 and a half, okay. Trillion cells, each with a nucleus carrying the DNA. So if you think about 13, 12, 13 trillion of anything in something the size of Richard's body, they are going to be small. Well, the nucleus is a tiny little compartment within that tiny little cell. And in each of those nuclei, there is 1 meter of DNA. 1 meter. 1 meter of DNA. And that means there must be 12 or 13 trillion copies of that in just one person. I find that amazing. And I remember, because I became a Christian as an undergraduate in my just at the beginning of my final year. And so I was doing the science. And I became a Christian, and the first time I read Psalm 139, I just thought, that's true. I'm fearfully and wonderfully made. Unbelievable. Unbelievable. So I was in science long enough to figure out that one. I then stopped working on polio and went to work. It was a bit of a fleece experience because I felt God was calling me to ministry. And Claire wasn't too hot on the idea initially. And I was thinking, I have no idea what this is going to look like, but we'll just keep praying about it. And so the fleece was, I'm going to leave my job in science. And if it's right to leave my job in science to go and train for the ministry, then the job I get will be great, and I'll stay in science for longer. So I put out the fleece, and I applied for a job, and through very strange circumstances, get this job. And this job is working on HIV. In the early days, this was the mid-late 80s, and HIV, the scourge of the planet at the time, was killing the most economically active people in every community in our world. And so having this amazing privilege of working and finding out about HIV. And so I started, and by the end of the first week, I knew, as far as employment was concerned, and fulfilling a lifetime of work in science, this was a disaster. And it wasn't going to last long. I just knew. I had a boss who had a fantastic corner office, windows looking over a beautifully landscaped rose garden. And he sat in his office with the Venetian blinds all closed all day when the roses outside. And I just thought, this guy's strange. Anyway, I won't go on about it. I left science and did about a year, just over a year in HIV, and went and trained for the ministry. And so that was for me the first experience of letting go. Of letting go of something that I was in. I had what they called in those days tenure, which meant I could have stayed forever, but I just knew God was calling on to something different. So I went and trained at London Bible College, it was called then. It was the London School of Theology now, isn't it? It's called something different. And during the first year of the 3 years spent at LBC, we met a guy, you'll recognize the name, Steve Chalk, who in those days was in charge of a very small organization then called Oasis Trust. And he came and did a youth mission in the town we lived in, which was Tring in Hertfordshire. And during that week, and also the accumulated experience that I was getting at LBC, My faith was being radicalized. And I just knew I could not be, at this stage of my life, the minister. It was a Baptist. I was going to be a Baptist. We were part of a Baptist church then. I couldn't be a Baptist minister of an ordinary church in a place like Tring. And Steve challenged us by saying, well, look, if you still feel that's the case when you come to the end of your degree, then get in touch and we'll see what can happen. So the next episode of Letting Go was getting in touch with Steve and him saying, well, look, Oasis has just moved into a redundant church in the bottom end of Towerbridge Road in London SE1 in a place called Bermondsey. And it's rough. And he said, when you move in, don't move too close because no one who's been born locally is normal. That's what he said. That's what he said. We're going, really? But anyway, so the next letting go was selling our house, our beautiful house in Tring, and moving into one of the roughest, grottiest bits of southeast London that you could possibly think of. The only advantage it had was that you could walk to London Bridge Station and get back to Tring quite quickly. We left Tring, and we've still got the house in Bermondsey 27 years later, and two of our kids are in it. We've told them that we've grown up and we've left home. And they're welcome to it. They're living mortgage-free, walking to work in London SE1. They are, two of the three of them live there, the other one lives in the States. They are two of the luckiest young people, and we keep reminding them that's the case. So, leaving a career to go into church leadership, knowing something about science and HIV, and we basically lived there for I worked at Haddonhall Baptist Church for 3 years, half my time for Oasis Trust and the other half for the church. And it was just not sustainable long term because both jobs wanted 100%. So we went to the equivalent of the bishop and said, look, we want a full-time church position in the inner city, but we can't be doing this split anymore, because it's just driving us potty. And by that point, we had 1.5 children, I think. One going on 2, I think. Anyway, just at that moment, somebody showed me a job ad for an HIV/AIDS advisor in Tear Fund. And I got very excited about this thought. Claire wasn't so excited about it. But we decided we'd go for it. I'd go for it, but we weren't going to move. We would stay put. And anyway, I applied for it, and to our huge surprise, I got the job. And that felt, yes, this is right. It felt completely right. And I was with Tear Fund for 10 years altogether. But what it did, it led me on a journey of discovery and participation that I had no idea I was going to be encountering. And it was the beginning of a second journey. It was a journey into the embracing brokenness and embracing paradox. In Nairobi, there is a slum. It's huge, and it's called Kibera. If any of you have watched the film Constant Gardener, that's the slum that is the location. Kibera has something like 1 million people living in it, in a space half the size of Rugeley. That's how chaotic and awful it is. And I remember I was one of Tear Fund's partners working on HIV in Kibera was the Salvation Army. And I visited the Salvation Army Church in the middle of Kibera, and we did some house visits. We went around the slum. And we visited one home, which was a corrugated shack, one room, one space, the size probably from the white line to the wall square. And in that house led a family of orphans. The oldest was a girl called Alison, I think her name was. She was 21 years old. And there were 10 of them down to very young. And Alison was the leader of this family. And she spoke eloquently about how she tried to keep the house clean, how she had to really work hard to get the money to pay for the uniforms, for the children to go to school and to feed them and everything. And my colleague said, asked the question, "So Alison, what is the biggest challenge you have every day, you face every day?" And she said, she wasn't embarrassed to say, she said, "The biggest challenge is saying no to the men who come to my door every day wanting to pay for sex." Every day, multiple times. And she said, "What would it be? What would happen to me? What would happen to my brothers and sisters if I once said yes?" So every day, saying no to that tantalizing prospect of having money easily to pay for food and clothes. And she said no every time. That was her reality. The Salvation Army Church, she was a joyful, joyous member of that congregation. And the reality of that suffering, the reality of that grimy, gritty existence really hit me. I've got a picture here also in a different continent. I took this photograph. You're not supposed to take photographs when you're a development professionalist. It's called development tourism. You shouldn't be doing it. But I couldn't resist whipping out the camera. I was at one of the hundreds of railway stations in Mumbai, and there isn't such a thing as an empty or not very crowded station in Mumbai. They are all incredible. And not just the stations, but the people who live on the tracks, literally. The people who live under the platforms. The people who just are everywhere. And these two lads were begging on the platform. And I stood there, and our daughter Catherine and our son Joel were pretty much the same age. And I remembered Psalm 139. I just thought, these guys are just as fearfully and wonderfully made as my two kids, living a very privileged existence. They are clean, they are well fed, they go to school, they've got parents who love them. And I saw these two guys. Here we see brokenness, but incredible beauty. Incredible beauty. Life. And what I was experiencing at that time in my career was a journey that had to embrace the brokenness. I couldn't do anything for these guys other than to make them live permanently in my memory. This lives on my office wall. So a journey into brokenness and living with the paradox. Brené Brown. Anybody heard of Brené Brown? Brené Brown is a researcher. She's an academic from America. And she tells the story of after she had a breakdown in her midlife. She had a breakdown. And the way she says it was that I read all the books on going back to church after a midlife crisis that she could get her hands on. And she read these books, and their advice was, yeah, go back to church and just keep anonymous, keep a low profile, it'll be fine. And Brené's mindset was, if I go to church, perhaps that will take the pain away. Perhaps if I go back to church, I'll find resolution. I'll find some closure on things that have hurt me in the past, and the pain will go away. She went to church, and her words were, "I went to church and found a midwife telling me to push." Now, you women will get that. I found a midwife telling me to push. And she talks about what it is that God might want to bring to birth in our lives. What it is to bring to birth something that he wants in our lives. So another picture of brokenness, but paradox. Beauty, resurrection. Without suffering, there is no resurrection. And I've been thinking a lot recently that how much energy and emotional space do we invest in keeping suffering at arm's length? Which is one of the most futile things that we could possibly do. Because the one thing that connects all of us is the experience of suffering at one time or other in our lives. Christ didn't come and live a charmed life. He came and suffered. He came to suffer. And through the suffering, it found and experienced resurrection. He set the pattern for you and me and for his church. So this journey of embracing brokenness and paradox isn't just about other people's brokenness. It's about our own brokenness and our attitude towards it and the gift that it is so that we can actually relate to other people with whom we have this incredible common bond. We had the first parish weekend that I think St. Augustine's or the parish has had forever, I think. They used to have weekends away at a place called Shallowford, which word had it, I got the feedback, well, no, the religious people go on that. You know, the really religious people. And I came along and I said, we're going to have a parish weekend and it's going to be great. We're not going to go to Shallowford, we're going to go to Swanwick, to the Hayes Conference Centre, and we're going to have a real treat. And they're going, really? No. Is it going to be all religion? And it wasn't. And it was fantastic. Eventually, we got 70 people going. And they've all come back fantastically enthusiastic about the weekend. And one of the sessions, one of the few really sort of reflective and devotional sessions we had was called Encountering God. And it was simply an invitation for everybody in small groups to think of a time in their lives when they've been particularly conscious of God being close to them. And do you know what? As they sat around, first of all, there were tears shed at every table, which was quite amazing. But secondly, most of the stories they told were of how God had been with them in suffering, in moments of suffering. And people who I kind of got to know on a, you know, fairly superficial level were sharing the most fantastic stories of brokenness, but out of that, the experience of resurrection that they had found, the support and the help that God had been to them and the church had been to them. So when we think about suffering and the ministry that we do, the brokenness we encounter, let's not think that we're being all heroic and doing nice things, but it resonates with our own experience of suffering, of brokenness, so that we can empathize, so that we can say, in the midst of your suffering, our suffering, your suffering is our suffering, it's my suffering. When you dig deep into when you weep, I weep. When you laugh and celebrate, I laugh and celebrate. You dig deep into that. While there are people like those boys in this world, the people in Syria, the people living in broken, traumatized experience, their suffering is our suffering. Let's never forget that. And we know our story is that resurrection comes from the heart of that suffering, out of that experience. The third journey, That might sound a little bit existential, but it is. The journey of letting go is a journey of letting go of fearfulness, of anxiety, of concern. From, again, personal experience, when I have been so concerned and bound up in the past with what happened in the past, and when I've been so wretchedly anxious about something that is going to happen in the future, when my headspace is in one of those or both of those things, I'm not in the moment. I'm very little use to anybody. And living in now, now is the only moment in time which lasts forever. The past is the past. The future is the future. Now. That is where God calls us to live. That is where it is now. I can't encounter anyone unless I'm fully present. What use am I if I'm spending half my brain is over there in the future and the other half is back in the past? So this journey, this third journey, is a journey to be present now. Not to be so concerned about the form of my life, my achievements or lack of, my aspirations, my concerns, and the degree to which I am defined. I allow myself to be defined by past mistakes. To let go of those things is liberating and enables God to be able to use me, to use you, by being present in the moment. There was a moment in Lewisham, in the church where I was a curate, between 2013 and 2016, before coming here. We did a lot of work with the psychiatric unit next door to St. Mary's. It was a psychiatric unit run by South London and Maudsley NHS Mental Health Trust. And we used to get a lot of people coming in with hour passes, so a pass to come out of the ward for an hour. They had to be back. Sometimes they'd come accompanied. Sometimes they'd come unaccompanied. Sometimes they'd come in their dressing gowns. Sometimes they would come weirdly dressed. But they'd come. And they'd come into the church, and I'd often go downstairs from up in the office and come in, and there'd be somebody sitting in the pews. Well, one day, I was in the office, and we had a fantastic, beautiful grand piano in the church downstairs. And I was aware that someone was playing this beautifully. And I let it go for a bit, and I just thought, I wonder who's playing the piano. This is amazing. So I went downstairs, and I went through the door, and this lady in her dressing gown was playing the piano phenomenally beautifully. I went through the door, and she stood up. She said, "Oh, I'm sorry, burst into tears. I'm so sorry. It's just that I feel better when I play." I said, "Sit, play." Now, if I was worried about how was I going to get rid of her, or remembering what got nicked last time we had the doors open, I'd be thinking, okay, let's move this on. Let's move her out. Lovely to see you. What use is that? What use was that? So I told her, sit, play for me. Play for us. You play superbly. And she just said, I feel calm when I play. And that led on to all sorts of interesting things in terms of groups coming in and performing, mental health service users, as they're horribly called, writing poetry that we had the Guildhall School of Music students putting to music and putting an amazing concert on. It was just being in the moment, taking the moment as it came, not worrying. Now, it's easy to say that at the towards the end of a career, towards the second half of life stuff. If I'd only known then what I know now, perhaps it would have been different. But this, I need to move on, because I just want to say that those for me sum up what discipleship includes. I'm not going to say it's all about those, because there's many other aspects. But for me, in my experience, what God calls us to in terms of denying ourselves, picking up our cross daily, and the glimpses of glory that we get when we do that, these are the journeys that I'm on. Haven't stopped being on. I don't think we ever stop being on these journeys. But that's, so it's the journey. Participation is about letting go. We've let go once more 2 years ago when we left London. I never thought I'd get used to living in Bermondsey. It took me, how long? 10 years? Not to moan about living in Bermondsey. I go back now. I went back on Friday evening to see a friend, and I just thought, oh, it's great to be back. Public transport. And it was just, but so we've been called to let go again, called to come back that looks remarkably like Tring. It's got the canal. It's got the Chilterns instead of the Chase. It's got exactly the same railway line going through it. It goes through Rugy Trent Valley. So here we are. We've let go, and we seem to have come full circle. But I am on these journeys, and I find myself a Church of England vicar. I mean, God has got a sense of humor. And the wonderful thing is that after the career I've had, I don't care. I keep saying to people in the parish when they think, ooh, could we do that? I said, show me the book that says you cannot do it and you can't do it. Do it. Experiment. And it's working. People are starting to come out of their shells, have ideas, trying things out. God, those God stories, they're starting to happen in the fuzzy old, fuddy-duddy old Church of England. They're starting to happen. Alleluia. And so we are starting to talk about these journeys. What is it that God is calling us to let go of today? What is he asking us to pick up today? What is he asking us to embrace in terms of our own brokenness and the brokenness of others? What beauty do we see in that brokenness? And are we present in the now so that we are any good at all to God and his kingdom? Amen. Should we just spend a moment praying? Father God, every minute of every day is a gift from you. Every breath is a gift from you. As we breathe in your presence. Open our eyes, our ears, every sense to your presence in us, in the moment, in the now. We thank you for your call upon our lives to pick up our crosses and to deny ourselves, to leave behind our false ambitions. Help us to let go of those things that we cling to, and help us to pick up those things that you would have us pick up. In Jesus' name, amen.